This was the first time I'd ever been inside a boxing club, so I was a little bit apprehensive. As I got closer to the ring, I saw the two combatants sparring hard, but the first thing I was aware of was the noise, the grunt of the boxer as he let rip, and the thudding whoosh through the air as the tanned leather hit muscle. I watched from a safe distance before this week's guest and manager of the Neasden Boxing Club, Xavier Miller, wandered over from ringside to greet me. Xavier was fascinated with boxing from a small lad, but his own career was cut short due to injury. He was a special needs teacher in London for many years before he followed his first love, and now coaches over 16 professional boxers and encourages all who come through his doors not only to achieve the best in boxing, but to become the best person they can possibly be. Each week, I'll be asking my guest to tell us one or two of their favourite secret places to visit in London, whether it's a restaurant, pub, museum, or simply a lovely walk. So make sure you listen to the end of the show, where my guest will spill the beans on their legacy reveal. I'm Steve Lazarus, and this is Your London Legacy. Well, I have to confess that today I'm a little bit out of my comfort zone for a change. Normally I'm sitting in someone's office or in a nice place in London, but today I'm in a boxing club. Mm-hmm. So completely out of my comfort zone, and I'm with a very special guest today, Xavier Miller, who is the head coach of the boxing club here in Neasden. So welcome to Your London Legacy, Xavier.
Okay, thank you for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. You were introduced, I suppose, by a previous guest, Sophia Bomick, who I believe is your agent.
My sports agent.
Your sports agent. So we've got some synergy there at least, so I don't feel completely, totally at a loss here. But when I walked in here and walked close to ringside, I suppose, I think it's the closest I've ever got to two people beating the living daylights out of each other. So it's a completely new experience for me.
That's okay. You come spa day.
So you're going to have to make me feel comfortable and at ease. So we're here because not only do you run an amazing boxing club, but you've got a pretty interesting story that goes with it as well, how you transitioned from being a primary school teacher and your journey through that. You've become a professional boxing coach as well.
Yep.
So you've got a hell of a story, and it's a London-based story as well, which makes it all the more appealing to our listeners. So first of all, what was your passion in boxing? What stage did you think you were interested in boxing?
I've been interested in the sport of boxing since I was about, I'd say, 10 or 11 years old. Uh-huh. My uncle got me into boxing. You know, he used to buy the boxing news every week, so then I started buying the boxing news. I used to actually do a paper round every week just so I could afford to buy the boxing news. And then when I got a little bit older, I only took a couple of years, then I worked in a car wash and a garage on a Saturday morning because I wanted to be able to afford to buy that magazine. And it just went from there. He used to tell me which fighters to study, which fighters to look at, because he knew that I had a passion for boxing, and it just went from there.
So 8 years old seems quite young to sort of get an interest in a sport, which is, you know, obviously a physical sport.
Yeah, around 10, 11 years old, yeah.
I mean, was there other sort of boxing influences, you know, within the family from your parents or your siblings, or was it just, I mean, how old are you? Let's get this in context, first of all.
What's my age now?
How old are you now?
I'm 46.
So when you're 8, we're going back to the 70s, I guess.
Yes.
In the 70s. So boxing was popular in the 70s.
Very.
Very popular in the 70s, wasn't it? So were you able to sort of watch it on telly?
My uncle and my dad, they used to like watching the big fights. Mm. So the Muhammad Ali's, sure. The Fab Four, you know, you had Tommy Hearns, Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvin Hagler. Uh-huh. Used to be a fan also of Donald Curry. Used to watch all these, you know, all-time great fighters at that time. And I hadn't actually walked into a gym until I was maybe 13, 14. But I actually got into boxing because I used to study boxing all the time, like every day after school. I mean, even when my father left early in the morning, I was watching boxing. When he came home, he used to come home late, I was watching boxing. So that's what I used to do every single day in the morning and when I got home from school. And
when you say watching boxing, you're watching what, replays of old
watching,
sort of boxing?
Watching videos.
On VCR or something, I'm guessing.
Yeah, watching VCR videos over and over again. And one day, I think the head teacher said there was going to be a boxing program at the school. And this gentleman walked in, said he's going to be doing a boxing club once a week. I went on the first day and I was the only one that attended. And I went the following week and he said there'll be no more boxing. And I said, why? You know, I said, I'm really interested in learning it. And he said there was no interest, so he had to stop doing the after school program. But then he said if you're that interested, he said, I do have a setup at my house. And it was a bit at those times, it was a bit strange for me to, if I said to my parents that that's what I was going to do, they would have said no way.
Dad, I'm going back to some stranger's house to learn about boxing.
Yeah, they would have said no.
Yeah.
So I started going, and
So you went, so you went without your parents' consent?
Yeah.
Well, you just snuck off after school, did you?
Yeah. And I started going regularly. He was from Malta, but he was a trainer in Detroit. So what was interesting was all the fighters that I'd been studying all those years, he was teaching a very similar style. And the connection was just there. He had a very, very small setup in his garage. The ring was really small, and he taught me so many different things. And I felt so comfortable with the way that he was teaching me, I became obsessed with it.
So this was your first real
coach.
Life experience of...
Yeah.
Do you remember how you felt when you sort of walked in and stepped into the ring?
I felt very comfortable.
Yeah.
I think the first like 4 or 5 months, it was frustrating because he wouldn't let me punch. It was just footwork, defense. I wanted to practice the stuff that I've been watching. And he brought somebody in to move around with me. And I said to him before it started, I said, well, you haven't taught me how to punch. So I don't know what I'm doing. But then I moved around with the guy, but the guy couldn't hit me. So then he said to me, okay, come back tomorrow. And then we started working on punching. So it was, you know, I had total trust in what he was telling me. But shortly after, maybe 11 months later, he died. I went round to the house, and one of his family members were there, and he left a letter. He didn't even tell me that he was ill. So that was really, really hard to take.
He left a letter for you?
He left a letter for me, yeah. Saying he basically said to me that I would go all the way. I would be a champion, without a doubt.
Do you still have that letter?
Yeah. I still got it. It's in my mum's loft. And it was a difficult period to get over. I went to a few different amateur boxing gyms. I think one of the first ones I walked into was All Stars, but it didn't feel like what he was teaching me. Every gym I went to, they said, oh, you're really good, but we don't understand what it is you're doing, because I was boxing a bit different to what everyone else was doing. They had most of the guys that I went to the gym to spar or was training with, they were quite upright. You know, they didn't really use their shoulders to roll punches or anything like that. So yeah, I started feeling a little bit uncomfortable, and I kind of got put off boxing for a while. I still was studying boxing all the time, watching boxing all the time, but the actual physical side of it.
So this is still when you were a young boy?
I was still young. Yeah. The physical side of it, I wasn't that interested in it anymore. And then a few years later, I decided to give it a go. So I went to apply for my boxing license, professional license. It was rejected due to health issues. If I'd known what I know now, it wasn't that much of a big deal, but at the time, my doctor said to me that he wouldn't even refer me to the doctors at British Boxing Board because I wouldn't get passed. So I just gave up on boxing, well, being a boxer, and I got involved in coaching. And this is where it gets interesting, because I'd had someone who'd been a fantastic teacher. I didn't look at him as a coach. He was a teacher. He taught me everything. And I wanted to be able to teach it to somebody. So I actually got involved in education because I wanted to learn to teach like people how to box, because I understood that everybody has a different learning style. So I wanted to have a different approach to each person and treat them as an individual. So that's where I got involved in mentoring at first, at a primary school. Then I started working as a Senko, which is a special educational needs coordinator.
I know, my wife was one for 30 years.
Yeah, I did that for quite a while in a primary school.
Okay.
And then I basically got conned into moving to a secondary education. At the time, the school that I was working at, they said there's not enough male teachers, black male teachers was the word. And, you know, more of the young black students need more male role models. Uh-huh. So I moved to secondary. I'll be honest with you, I didn't like it. I think I spent 9 years in primary. And then eventually, before I retired from education, I spent about 10 years in secondary.
So what was the biggest difference between primary and secondary that you really thought, I can't handle it, or I don't like? I mean, 10 years is still a fair crack of the whip.
Yeah.
Not like you didn't give it a go. But what was the thing that sort of put you off it most?
I think this it's just the discipline, the behavior. I think there's a problem with the transition from primary to secondary. There's a lot of nurturing in primary. And when you move, progress to secondary, you've still got support, but it's not the same level of support. So
you're left to your own devices more.
Yeah. I mean, you were basically forced to read and have spelling tests and so on in primary. But in secondary, I don't think the routine was as strict. It tends to be the case that when you're moving on to years 9, 10, you're preparing for your GCSEs or, well, O-levels, A-levels, those times. So then the routine becomes more strict. But I think that period, I think from years 7 and 8, I think that's where it needs to be a little bit tighter. And like I say, I actually progressed onto a mainstream school at first. Then I went to what you call a PRU, which is a pupil referral unit with students with behavior difficulties.
So this is kids who can't, for want of a better word, can't cut it within the mainstream education. Yeah. And they have to, they're asked politely, we can't manage you within the mainstream education system. Here's a special school where we can look after you better.
Yep.
They might be disruptive or they might have special needs or whatever. Yeah.
Exactly. And I did that for a period. And then I decided, I had an idea to start a company called IQ Boxing. And I actually left my old school so that I could concentrate on this company full time. And it got quite tough. So I said, let me register with a couple of agencies and just do some pickup work here or there in schools. And the first school I got sent to, you know, I met my business partner, who is now my business partner, Nicholas Prempe. And I spoke to him about this company, IQ Boxing, and what we could do with it. You know, we became quite close. I stayed in that school for a number of years. For a period, I was an acting head teacher for about 6 months.
Which school was this?
It's a school in Hammersmith.
Uh-huh. So that's West London.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I had a really good, had great friends there, built some really good relationships. And over the last, I'd say, 3-4 years at the school, I started to reduce my days. First, it was half a day, then it was a day. And that was just so I could have enough time to concentrate on this company. And, you know, me and my business partner, we spoke and we both agreed that, listen, I'd have to do this full time. And while he's still in education and, you know.
So he was a teacher as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
So were you running like a boxing club within the school?
The only thing we were doing there were boxing. We were doing, I think maybe weekly, we might have been doing like a P session because obviously everything gets broken down into modules. So. Yeah. They'd be doing football 1 week, then tennis, and then we introduced boxing, which worked really well.
But had you been training yourself, you know, doing sparring sessions yourself, as you've been going through your sort of schooling career as a teacher?
I'd continue to spar, yes.
So you'd kept your hand in as a trainer?
Yeah, I used to do crazy, things, yeah, like pick up my gym bag and just get on the train and just go to a gym. And then I'd spar, and they'd say to me, oh, you know, you're good, could you come back next week? And I said, no, it's okay. I got what I wanted, you know, from that journey.
But you'd had no formal training since you were a kid, since that the Maltese gentleman.
No, until I didn't actually have another coach until I was 30 years old. I met two brilliant coaches. One's called Earl Austin and the other one's Ken Thomas. They're both well known at the All Stars gym because they've spent time there. They got me back into the physical side of boxing. So I used to actually go to train every Saturday and we used to always spar. So I'd always kept that part of the boxing going. But I then fell in love with the idea of coaching.
Had you been making visits to watch live bouts as well? Had you been going?
Always.
You've constantly been?
Always. I've always, either I've gone to amateur boxing shows or professional. And I was always the guy sitting at the back and just observing because I used to watch the guys in the corner. And I spent a lot of my time watching coaches. You know, and I just developed a style that was really comfortable for me. I wanted to talk to fighters in a certain way so they could, they knew they were being respected, and then I'd get the best out of them. So I was trying to watch different coaches, see how they function. I used to actually go to sparring sometimes just to watch how the coaches dealt with their fighters.
So you were more, it sounds to me like you were more interested in the training side and understanding the mentality and the psychology of
absolutely
teaching.
Yep.
The boxers to improve their style, their method, you know, their mentality, all the rest of it, rather than pursue yourself having a career in boxing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. What was it that interested you? What was the fascination behind that?
I reached a crossroads where I knew that I wasn't going to be able to be a professional boxer. I was depressed for a long, long time about it because I just always knew that I was better than everybody else. I just felt very, very comfortable what I was doing. And the fact that I wasn't going to be able to do it, I just said, listen, you know, you've had great coaches, great teachers, you know, you should just give back.
Hmm. What was the medical condition or problem that you had that ruled you out?
I mean, there was a couple of things. I'd actually had a dislocated shoulder, and that wasn't from boxing. That was an accident at work. And then also I've got mild asthma now, but at the time asthma was quite severe. So this is the reason why the doctor was reluctant to, you know, really apply for my boxing license. And it was a really, really difficult period, which I dealt with on my own. I've never actually spoken to my parents about it. I've never sat them down and spoken about it ever.
What, the reasons why you never pursued professional? Well, the medical reasons why you never pursued it?
Never actually spoke about it. They just, all they know is that I had a real interest in boxing and that I'm a boxing coach.
Hmm. But so what age was it that you had this rejection in your career?
I think I must have been around, I lost my coach at about 15 years old. I really wasn't interested in boxing at all for about another 5-6 years. And got back into it slowly, maybe 24, 25.
Right.
Maybe.
So right at a point in your life when you thought, I could make something of this. I could make a career of boxing myself.
And funny enough, it's only dislocated once or twice. It's only actually popped out again once or twice. So yeah, it's just, you know, that was a frustrating period, but I found peace years ago.
So you were quite low about this whole thing.
Yeah, for a long time. For a long, long time.
So was there a time when you thought, well, if I can't do that, I can at least train and be involved in the industry by training and coaching?
I mean, that was always the plan.
That was
always
the backstop.
Even back then, as young as I was, my coach was teaching me things that were, he said, you know, you're going to have a life after boxing.
Sure.
And he said, you know, more than likely, you're going to want to be involved in the sport in some capacity. So he used to teach me how to wrap hands and things like this. It was just, at the time, I was thinking, why are you showing me that for? I've got no interest in anything like that. But funny enough, everything he said to me at the time was just, you know, just come to fruition now. Yeah. Just, you know, it's just, and all the guys I've got here obviously benefiting from it.
It's amazing, isn't it? That meeting you had with that guy, chance meeting, this Maltese chap.
Yeah, you know.
The legacy he's left you in, and now you're passing on.
Yeah.
So you, for want of a better word, you quit school. You went into partnership with this, your colleague.
Yeah, I'd spent nearly 20 years in education.
Yeah.
I felt that I'd given enough.
Yeah, so to say quit is not fair. You reduced your time in school and then you decided to pivot, I suppose, and move in a different direction and follow your passion, which was boxing and training.
Yeah.
So how did that go? I mean, what was the first thing you had to do to...
I think when I handed in my resignation, when I got home, I was scared. This is about 3 years ago, I think, about 2.5-3 years ago. Yeah, I was nervous because, you know, you get used to earning a certain amount of money. Everyone's got their bills to pay. You know, I've always been independent. I've been working since I was 13, 14, earlier. I've got one son.
Yeah.
I've got a wife. I'm married.
So responsibilities.
I've got responsibilities, yeah. So I was really nervous. But, you know, I've just been really fortunate. And for me to be able to do what I love every single day was worth all the pain.
Yeah. And they were supportive, were they, of your move or anxious?
Yeah, I mean, the head of trustees at the school that I left, her name's Sarah Evans. She's been supportive since the day that I met her. I think I met her in 2008, and anything I ever needed throughout my whole time in education, she made sure it happened. You know, if I needed extra funding for whatever reason, she was always very supportive. And when I said I was going to, you know, hand my resignation in, again, supportive. I mean, even financially, a couple of times she said, listen, you know, I'll contribute this to the club, you know, to help you get started. So she'd become a very dear friend.
Excellent. So how long has this club been running now? How long have you been head coach here?
I think me and my business partner have been here for 6 years. And that was an interesting concept as well, because I was actually looking for a gym. And my first boxer that I actually taught to box, he used to live near here. And he said they do have a boxing club down the road. And when I actually walked in the building, they were actually going to close it the following week, because the person who had been running it, they've only had about 3 or 4 people actually coming to the boxing class. And I said to the lady here, Miss Matthews, who was here at the time, I said, can you just give me 2 weeks? Can you just let me run it for 2 weeks? And I think after about 2 or 3 sessions, there was 30 plus people in here, and it's been packed like that ever since. I've actually had to split an evening class because there's too much people here. So we've actually got 3 sessions now instead of 2, because I have the juniors coming early, and that's from 11 to 17 years old. And then I've got the amateur boxers who actually box for the club, and they come from 6 till 7:15. And then we've got more of a keep fitters boxing class from 7:15 till about 8:30. And that's 3 times a week.
So you're busy, you're flat out nonstop, and it's been like that ever since you took over.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah. It's just been building. And that's just the amateur side of it. You know, I obviously now have 15 professional boxers.
15,
yeah.
You train out of this site here?
Well, the professionals train out of Don Charles Boxer Gym in Mill Hill.
Where I'm from, Mill Hill. Yeah. Just around the corner from me.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. You're Mill Hill as well?
Yeah, Mill Hill, yeah.
We could have met there.
I live near Coptall.
So do I. How bizarre. So, okay.
Yeah, Don's a very dear friend of mine. He's had some really good fighters. Derek Jezora, Frank Buglioni. He's always had good boxing.
Were you involved in the training of Derek Jezora?
I was involved with Derek's training camp for his last 3 fights.
Okay.
Before he's moved on.
He's a character, isn't he?
Yeah, interesting character. Really good fighter. A lot of heart. Got a lot of time for Derek.
What belts does he hold currently?
I don't think he holds a belt at the moment.
Yeah.
But he's won a lot of belts. His one is the British and European and so on. Yeah. It's just the world he didn't actually.
Well, he's had some big fights, hasn't he?
He's had some major fights, yeah.
Is it Dillon Whyte?
Dillon Whyte was a good fight. Yes.
Yeah. See, I'm not a boxing fan, but I know some of the key names, and he's obviously well known, isn't he, for chucking tables and furniture around at people.
Oh my God. I didn't know him when he was doing that. I know a much calmer version of Derek.
Good. Yeah. Glad to hear it. Should save that for the ring. So what is it? What are the personality traits you think that make a boxer, from a decent boxer to a good boxer, from a good boxer to a great boxer? What is it between the head, you know, between the ears, first of all, that
every time I have an interview or I speak to my boxers, I always tell them the same thing. It's the same thing my coach said to me, my first coach. A boxer or fighter has to behave like a fighter when the time comes. And when I say that, I mean, boxing's a hard sport. It's not always going to go your way. You can get knocked down. You know, you can lose a fight. You can be tired in the ring. But what do you do at those moments? And for me, if you have that, that's the main asset you must have for me as a fighter. You have to behave like a fighter when the time comes. If you've got that, everything else, I personally believe that I can teach.
What do you mean? Do you mean like a never say die sort of attitude?
Yeah, you have to have the heart.
Or be stoic in the sense that, as you said, you will lose probably as many as you win, maybe more than you win sometimes. I don't know, it depends on your where you are on your journey.
Yeah.
And that you've got to accept that with good grace.
Yeah.
And move on and just be prepared to learn, have an open mind.
Yeah, every boxer has a different makeup. You know, some are just naturally athletic, some are naturally strong, some are naturally fast. But, you know, you have to get in the ring and fight, you have to have a lot of heart and you have to have the right mentality, you know, and the determination. Sometimes you get in the ring and there's a guy who's just better than you. But what decisions are you going to make at that time? What are you going to do? You know, you have to be able to do something else, you know, to win that fight. And if you're showing me that, then honestly, you've got me. I've got all the respect in the world for you. Everything else can be developed and taught over time. Some fighters take 2 years to get it. Some take 10. Some take 15. It all depends on the individual. That's why you have to train every fighter individually.
I mean, the fact that you say treat each of them differently. I mean, that's obviously a throwback to your teaching days and your Senko days, because each of the kids has to be.
You have to, yeah.
You know, they're different learners, aren't they?
Yep.
Whether they're touchy-feely or emotional or physical or, you know, the way they see or hear things. Everyone learns in a different way. But boxing, you got to learn pretty damn quick, haven't you?
Yeah, you do. And it's good. The other thing that a coach must do, obviously, is their job is to protect their fighter. So you have to move them along their journey at their pace. You know, everybody's ceiling, their journey is different. Some guys I've got in my gym are good enough to win a Southern Area title. Others are good enough to win a British title. Others are good enough to win a European. And if you're lucky enough, some fighters are good enough to win a world title.
Really? But you think you've got that quality, level of quality?
I think one or two are good enough to win a world title.
Seriously?
But, you know, I would have the same feeling or same level of respect as a person that I deem is good enough to win a world title as someone who wins a Southern Area belt. Because to me, that's their ceiling. Mm. You know, that's their test.
Yes.
You know, they might not be able to go past that level because that's how good they are.
Yeah.
It's not a knock. It's fine. I mean, to me, winning any title it's an achievement. You know, a lot of people have tried and failed.
You said how upset, I think you said depressed you were when you found out you couldn't fight for physical reasons. I don't know how that impacted you, you know, for how long you were in a, you know, a depression of sorts, I guess.
Yeah.
So you must have some sympathy or empathy with some of the boxers who come full of high hopes and spirits, and they reach a plateau and it's not what they expect they're going to be.
Exactly. There's so many boxers who just can't. They can't box. You know, some fell a brain scan. Others, you know, I've had a boxer here who's dislocated both his shoulders before, so he can't box anymore. I've got another boxer here who's had a knee operation. We're just hoping that obviously he makes a full recovery and he's able to pursue his boxing career, because he's a good talent as well. You know, if you do get the opportunity to box, it's a blessing, because there's a lot of people out there who have the talent but are never going to get the opportunity to do it. So I would say, don't take it for granted. You know, once you're in that position, you are actually allowed to box. You know, take full advantage of it, because even the boxing career, you know, a boxer's boxing career is not long. It's very short. It's not like anyone else who has a normal 9-to-5 job. You know, they can retire at 65. You know, a boxer generally, you know, if you're a heavier weight, you can box into your 40s. If you're more of a featherweight, a lightweight, you know, usually around 30 is the that's as far as you'll be able to go. So you know, the time you have, make good use of it.
So do you train, so you're given the different segments that you train?
Yep.
Do you train from zero experience? Can kids walk in here with absolutely zero experience and just want to learn the ropes, as it were?
100%.
Yeah.
100%. You know, the gym is open to anybody. I mean, the whole point of me working with young people is because I want to find some way to support them. In my personal opinion, I think that it doesn't matter what job you're doing. I think you should be contributing in some form to society. So if a lot of young people are walking off the street and walking into this building and boxing, that means they're not out there getting themselves in problems, which means that I'm doing my part. I feel that even if whether you're an accountant, head teacher, whatever you're doing, you should be doing some form of charity work. You know, that you could do mentoring, football coaching, whatever it is. I think everybody should be volunteering some of their time to something.
So you see yourself in effect as a community leader as well as a boxing trainer.
Yeah, I like to think so. Yeah, I mean, there's other coaches now at this gym which are now supporting young people, and that's what's supposed to happen. You know, it's supposed to filter down. You're supposed to, you know, pass on what you know to somebody else so they can then help someone else.
Do they look up to you as like a mentor, both in terms of sort of life skills as well as boxing skills?
A lot of the boxers do, yeah.
Given that what you've experienced, you know, as a teacher and, you know, your upbringing and, you know, working out in some Maltese chap's garage, you know, you've had quite a rich and varied life, so they can look up to you.
I hope so. I want to be that figure where they feel they can come and basically talk to me about anything. And I want to have that relationship with them whereby, you know, if they're, you know, it's me and them in that fight. I know they're in the ring, but I'm in the corner to guide them. And the trust that a boxer has to have for a coach is second to none. I mean, that's probably the most important relationship you're going to have is, you know, if you're a boxer, you know, your relationship you have with your boxing coach has to be, you know, solid, has to be.
So what part of it gives you most satisfaction?
I think walking into this gym and working with boxers every single day gives me satisfaction. I'm really happy for them when they win something. You know, I'm happy that they set goals and they have higher standards themselves. I'm really happy that they give everything when they get into the ring. So yeah, every day I feel that way. I feel blessed in that way.
Do you think the youth today are of a want it now sort of attitude? They want instant gratification, instant success, more so than when you were growing up? Do you think, have you seen a change in mentality?
Definitely.
Really?
I think boxers, I actually believe that too many boxers are actually turning professional too quickly. They're not spending long enough in amateur boxing.
But that's the fault of the coach, presumably, because they can't turn professional without...
At times, definitely. I feel even when you have turned professional, that the expectation now of the fans is to throw two prospects in a lot earlier than they would have years ago, just because we want it now, whereby in a year, 2-3 years' time, it would be a better fight, because they both would have learn and develop more. But that's just the way things are. I would not throw any boxer that I've got into a fight that I didn't think they had a chance to win. I'll always evaluate the situation depending on the boxer's age. Obviously, if they're older, You have less opportunities, so you have to take a few more gambles. But if you're young, I've got boxers here that are 22, 23, and they're professional, which is a good age to turn professional if you're ready, because it takes a good 4 years, in my opinion, to learn to be a pro, or what it is to be a pro. A lot of amateurs think they do, and because they've had a lot of amateur fights, they feel that, you know, they're just ready for the professional game. But once you're actually in it, it's a different world.
I've no idea about this, the answer to this question. Is there money to be made as a pro at the lower level of the game? I mean, it's like a professional footballer at the top. You know, there's the billions and trillions. And at the lower end, it's much more sort of modest.
I think it's like the same in anything, really.
You can make a living, a journeyman pro living.
I think if you should really do your research beforehand. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a good ticket seller, a really good ticket seller, you can make good money. If you're a real talent, then a major promoter will pick you up. But on the other side, you know, if you don't sell enough tickets, your options are then limited.
So what makes a good ticket seller? Is it personality as much as anything, persona and character?
I think you need to do your homework like way in advance. If I decided, I would say to a young person, if you actually decide you want to be a pro, let's say in 3-4 years time, I would say in this day and age, go on social media, build up a fan base, get involved in some different activities, some different interests, and try and build up your fan base so they can follow your journey from now, so that when you turn pro, they're going to want to come and see you fight.
Fascinating. So branding is as important at the early stages, because when you're like the Joshuas of the world, I mean, you're going to sell out whatever you do. You just have to sneeze and people are going to sort of, hundreds of thousands of followers are going to turn
exactly.
up. But at the
exactly.
lower end, you've got to create an aura, an image, a persona around the brand, haven't you?
You do. If you're willing to do that, then I would say then... as well as if you're, and if you're talented, then to me, then it's worth turning professional. If you're talented and you don't, and you're not a good ticket seller, I think it's a gamble, because it's not a given that you're going to get picked up by a big promoter.
No, sure.
And then you could end up turning into what we call a journeyman. You know, a journeyman earns a lot of money. You know, they come to the fights, they make their money, and then they box the following week, and they're very good at what they do, but they've decided to take their boxing career down a different path.
Yeah. So for the young pro who wants to make it, they've got to build up this brand.
Yes.
But it's got to be a fine balancing act, hasn't it? They don't want to spend all their time working on their brand image and posting on Instagram nonstop at the expense of training hard and sparring regularly and listening to the coach.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you're going to box, you should at least train 2 times a day anyway. So that could include your runs in the morning, and then maybe you go to the gym midday or in the evening after work. But in between that time, you've got to put yourself out there. People have to know who you are. Mm. You know, you've got to create a buzz about you. There's got to be a reason why people are going to come and watch you fight.
For sure.
And whether you've created a character outside the ring that's interesting, or maybe you're just a really entertaining fighter in the ring. If you've got both, then wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. But first and foremost, you've got to be a good boxer.
Yes.
Otherwise, the rest of it is BS, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
As they say.
Yep.
Yeah, cool. So what are your plans for the club? I mean, you're full up, you're sold out, you've got no more space to take anyone else on by the sounds of it.
Yeah. You're
looking to expand or have a secondary base? Or
well, yeah, I mean, this is a community centre.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, me and my business partner, we're actually in discussions. We want to obviously set up our own gym. We want to find a premises where we can run IQ boxing. It's going to take time. I'm looking for... sponsors to come in and basically go into partnership so we can run this gym. At the same time, I'm looking for sponsors now, obviously, because I've got 15 professional boxers and I need more coaches to help me, you know, work with these boxers. What I'm trying to do is, instead of doing what a lot of gyms do, which is they charge the boxers to use the gym and then obviously the coaches charge for their time, I don't take anything at all from my boxers. Absolutely nothing. I don't take, obviously, I don't charge them to use the premises here, and I don't charge them for coaching. So what I'm doing is I've got a couple of sponsors in at the moment. I should say thank you to Bravos, a glove company, KMT, apparel clothing company, Queensgate Property Group. The money that they give me at the moment, I actually use it to pay the coaches so they can at least have travel expenses. So whether they will, if they drive or to get petrol, if not, they take transport, London transport. I pay for their oyster for the month so they can come here and work with these boxers. So that's how I'm running at the moment. So that's why I'm trying to, that's why I've got working with Sophie. Sports agent. Yep. So I'm looking to get more sponsors on board.
Okay.
Because obviously the more help that I have, the more I can help these boxers, because sure. a lot of times I've got some really good ticket sellers, and then I've got boxers who are not fantastic ticket sellers. And I would like to be able to say to a boxer, okay, you're fighting on this particular day, I'll buy, let's say, 4 or 8 ringside tickets from you. They're £65 each. So that will help contribute to the money that they've got to pay the promoter for being able to box on their show. And that's what I'm looking to do down the line, is just get, you know, more sponsors in, and just make everyone aware of the work that we're doing here. And a lot of the professional boxers that I do have now, they actually had their amateur career at this gym. So the transition's been great. I want them to continue their journey, and hopefully all of them pick up titles. I mean, I'm hoping to win maybe 3 or 4 titles this year.
At what sort
their
of
first
level?
Southern area, which uh-huh. is the early stages. I'm hoping to a couple of fighters will be winning titles this year, and then just keep progressing and moving up the ladder.
Do they get televised at that sort of level, or is it
at this level? No, because the promoter they're signed with is a small hall promoter, and I went down that route. I mean, I spoke to Don Charles from the Mill Hill Gym. He's a good friend of mine, and he advised me to go with Steve Goodwin. Steve Goodwin's a promoter who really looks after his fighters and makes sure the fighters go out regularly. And so I put all my faith in Steve. I think I've got 14 boxers signed with Steve Goodwin, and only one with another promoter. And I've got a really good relationship with Steve. So for me at this stage, the early stages of their professional career, is I need them to get as much experience as possible. Hmm. If they're good enough, they will end up being TV fighters.
So they've got to enjoy the journey, work, enjoy the journey, absolutely. And then the rewards will come afterwards.
Exactly. So
the trick is not to focus on the end game, really.
Yep.
It's to focus on the graft.
Yep, definitely. Yeah. And I actually prefer it that way. I think it's a process. I think it's an education, and understanding the business of boxing and understanding what it is to be a professional boxing takes time. And I think they all are starting to learn that. I think the idea that they may have had before they turn pro, I'm sure, is a lot different to what they're experiencing now.
You must have some boxers who come in here and they think, yeah, I don't, you know, I just go for the money. And you just sort of say, hang on a second, you know, it doesn't work like that.
A lot of them had a warped view.
Show them the door fairly promptly.
A lot of them had a warped view about it, well, of how this industry actually works. And they are getting they're getting a lesson now.
A rude awakening.
Yes, definitely.
Well, you're doing amazing work here, Xavier.
Thank you. Very impressive.
What you've done, what you've achieved, and what your plans are for the future. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure with Sophia sort of assisting in the background, you're going to go on to, I won't say bigger and better things, because I think what you've done is amazing. But you know,
I've got a great team around me, honestly, at the moment. Everyone's doing their part. You know, we all want the same thing. We all want these boxers to do really well. It's our job to make sure that, you know, their journey runs as smoothly as possible. There's going to be some bumps in the road, but
of course there are.
You know, it's for us to deal with that, and so they can solely focus on competing in the ring.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
I feel a little less apprehensive now walking outside. The two guys kicking the hell out of each other, punching the hell out of each other, not kicking. It's my first time here, and hopefully it won't be my last. Hopefully I'll come back and visit, you know, a real bout, perhaps.
Please, yeah, definitely. I've got 3 dates in March.
I know you've got something coming up at Camden, haven't you? I know it's...
There's an event. Mental health
awareness.
Yep, awareness in Camden, which Sophie Bomick's running. And then I've obviously got these 3 shows in March, so...
Okay, do you want to give a shout out for the dates? And
definitely, come down.
You got the 2nd of March, you've got a couple of bouts on?
I would say probably the most interesting date is going to be the 16th, because Kay Prosper is fighting for the English title against Sama Mason.
Okay,
and that's going to be at York Hall in Bethnal Green.
Excellent.
So I'll get you a ringside ticket for that one.
Oh, you're a good man. Thank you very much. It was worth a visit.
Yep, definitely.
So we're starting a new feature on Your London Legacy, and we're asking each of our guests 1 or 2 or 3 different places that they like, that secret place of them that they really fancy, that they can recommend to others. Give them a shout out. So Xavier, what's the place that you really like? You don't want everyone to go to, but you'd like to recommend it to a few people.
I would say the Banana Tree in West Hampstead.
Uh-huh.
I think it's a Thai restaurant, and a more commonplace TGI Fridays.
TGI's, that's cool. Anyone in particular? Where's your local TGI's?
Oh, there used to be one in Mill Hill, but it's gone. So that's why I haven't been for a number of years. So
we'll stick with Banana Tree then.
Banana Tree's
all
good.
Right, lovely. We'll put that on the list. Thanks, Xavier.
No problem.
Cheers. Every week here at Your London Legacy, we bring straight to your device a new and fascinating guest with a wonderful London-based story. We hope you enjoy listening to their timeless stories as much as we enjoy creating them for you. If so, the best way to show your appreciation is to subscribe to the show. Simply go to www.yourlondonlegacy.com and pop your name and email in the box where shown. That way, you'll never miss another episode. Thank you for your support.